From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The needs or requirements of people who've lived a potentially rarefied sort of movie existence or, you know, been on big sets with a lot of accoutrements and things like that can't be accommodated in a neorealist setting. So in some ways, the genre in which I work almost excuses itself or sort of sequesters itself from those conditions because it wouldn't be a happy marriage.
Director Deborah Granik gave Jennifer Lawrence her breakout role in her 2010 movie Winter's Bone. Lawrence skyrocketed to the highest levels of Hollywood stardom, while Granik has stuck to her indie roots, working with tiny budgets and lesser-known actors. For her new film, Leave No Trace, Granik's stars had to learn wilderness survival techniques. They had to spend time actually living in the woods as they prepared to play a father and daughter who make their home there, off the grid and out of sight. Granik tells us what she's been up to in the 8 years since Winter's Bone and explains how she imported the young actress playing the daughter in her newest film from New Zealand. But first on the news banter, Scarlett Johansson faces backlash again, this time over plans to play a transgender character. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we have another controversy over casting. This is increasingly a thing where people who are not whatever, Asian, transgender, are playing those roles, disabled. This comes up again and again. And in this case, for this particular performer, Scarlett Johansson, it has come up before. She had some blowback after being in Ghost in the Shell and playing a character that was originally an Asian character. And now she's got this new film that she's getting ready to star in called Rub and Tug. And that is the true story of Jean Marie Gill, who was assigned female at birth but assumed the identity of a man. This takes place in the late 70s and 80s. It's not surprising at all, I don't think, at this point, that transgender talent is saying, how come she gets this part and we would never be considered to play, you know, someone who is like us?
I am sensitive to both sides of this argument because I understand the push for inclusion and the fact that many of these roles have not gone to either trans or Asian or Latino or other actors. Whitewashing is a big problem in Hollywood. However, I do see the other side of the issue here, which is Scarlett Johansson is a major movie star who can get a movie like this made, financed, distributed all over the world merely by putting herself in the film. So if you're a producer of a film, getting Scarlett Johansson's a huge coup. You're going to do that. And if the cost of that is that you don't give a trans actor a chance, I think 99% of producers would take that chance.
Okay, so you're taking the pragmatic line from the studio point of view on that, which I totally understand. And I would also say, you know, beware of saying you can't play this and you can play that. However, from the equally pragmatic point of view from Scarlett Johansson's side of things, you've been through this before. This was, I think, very foreseeable. You have lots and lots of jobs that you could do, and you walk into this situation. Now, her representative gave a statement to these transgender performers. Tell them they can be directed to Jeffrey Tambor, which is an interesting choice, Jared Leto, and Felicity Huffman's reps for comment. Kind of salty. And, of course, those are allusions to Felicity Huffman playing a transgender woman in Trans America, I would say in 2005, quite a bit ago. Jared Leto actually won a supporting actor Oscar for playing a transgender woman in Dallas Buyers Club. And Jeffrey Tambor, of course, we know from Transparent, which led to its own problems. And I would say this, you know, I think the real key for me is an actress who did work on Transparent, Trace Lizette, who said, she tweeted this criticism, I wouldn't be as upset if I was getting into the same room as Jennifer Lawrence and Scarlett for cis roles, but we know that's not the case. Now, again, you can say, well, she is not a star of the magnitude of Jennifer Lawrence and Scarlett, but the point is no one has had the opportunity to become a star of that magnitude because people do not look to transgender talent to play these parts.
That is true, and I believe that Scarlett Johansson's statement is not good. I would not have made light of this situation. But, you know, on the other side of this, she has a point. There is a long tradition of actors playing characters that are not of their specific race, sexual identity, all different types of things. So you're essentially telling an artist that they cannot express themselves in a certain way if you're telling them that they can't play particular roles.
Yeah.
So that to me does offend me somewhat, but Trace Lissette is not wrong. There need to be more opportunities for trans actors to play all different types of characters. And I think you're seeing a little bit more of that than certainly there was 10 years ago or beyond, but it's not there and there are not these opportunities. So it's possible in this situation for everybody to be right, and it's just an unfortunate situation.
Until things get more equal, it will be a problem. Now, I'm going to turn to AT&T, which is now snapped up Time Warner, which is now called Warner Media. In their antitrust trial, they told the judge that they were going to lower prices for DirecTV customers. It's preposterous to think that this deal would lead to higher prices. And no sooner has the dust settled on this deal that, guess what? They raised the prices.
Yeah, I mean, does that surprise anyone? I mean, this is business 101. You work as hard as you can to get something through government hurdles, and then you operate your business. And the business of AT&T is connectivity, and they have now a gigantic asset, and they're going to raise the prices to their benefit. Anyone who thought differently is naive.
Yeah, we're getting to this place now, you know, where a lot of these streaming services also are raising prices. Recently, Sling TV raised the base price of its basic package by $5 a month. YouTube raised its prices in March to $40 per month. So it seems to me that as we have this showdown between the streamers and all these competitors, sooner or later, you know, it's going to be expensive for consumers and the cable bundle might start looking a little bit better again. I don't know if we're there yet, but I don't know how it all sorts itself out.
Well, the skinny bundle, so to speak, is almost always cheaper than the traditional cable package, hence the term skinny. But I think what you're going to see is the maturation of that market where these initially offered services that were $29.99, $39.99 to get you in the door, like all businesses, they're going to creep up in price. And then that begs the question is these subscribers that they're getting based on the price point, are they going to stick with it or are they going to find that the other option wasn't so bad? What interests me most is what's going to go on with Netflix, because Netflix has been on this spending spree and they've kept their price relatively low. They increased $1 in the US a couple of years ago, and they're testing some, they call it premium or ultra pricing in Europe, where they have a larger offering and more connectivity. I wonder how long Netflix is going to be able to keep their price low in the US and maintain the spending strategy, or whether they're going to have to offer different pricing tiers or increase wholesale for US customers.
They are going to definitely get us on that pipe and then raise the rates. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new movie Leave No Trace tells the story of a father and daughter living contentedly and almost invisibly off the grid in Forest Park, the 5,200-acre woods inside the city limits of Portland, Oregon. The father, played by Ben Foster, is a widowed veteran, adept at survival techniques but haunted by nightmares from his time in the service. He and his daughter Tom, played by 17-year-old Thomason Harcourt McKenzie, spend their days foraging for food, waterproofing their shelter, and practicing for the day when they might have to elude the authorities. That day comes sooner rather than later.
It's not a drill.
Leave No Trace is directed by Deborah Granick. Her previous feature, Winter's Bone, was an indie breakout in 2010, picking up 4 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actress for then-unknown Jennifer Lawrence. That was 8 years ago, so when we connected with Granick at a studio in New York, I had to ask, what has she been up to?
My answer lies in the genre of films that I like to create and work in, which is social realism. And so therefore, my home base is the East Coast, or if you want to call it the independent movement, wherever that occurs. And so to go to a larger franchise or a film that requires using traditional West Coast industrial mechanisms, such as star power and very large budgets, it doesn't suit the kinds of films that I get interested in and want to make. That's the basis for staying East or staying indie. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the other big player for me was that in this particular instance, right after Winter's Bone, I got involved with a film that dealt with life after incarceration. It was a fiction script. And as I started started to work on that film and do research. The project really blossomed, meaning in its themes and its weight. It's become a documentary because it exceeded sort of the bounds of fiction. Mm. And so this has been a project that's taken a lot of my time because the research is very, it goes on and on, let me put it that way. But we filmed for 4 years, so hopefully that's the project that my colleagues and I can complete now. We have the footage we need to edit, which is a big deal.
So with a film like that, I imagine it takes a long time to cobble together financing because it's not like an obvious, popular commercial hit.
That is absolutely correct. And that's part of the process that takes the time, which is scripts and stories and documentary subjects have to be looked at by a variety of people. But it doesn't mean that we can't keep working. It doesn't mean that we don't keep filming if it's a documentary or that we don't keep writing or doing the research on the script, like going to the locations. We try to set things up while waiting for the financing, which is slow.
And how do you survive? I mean, how do you keep yourself in cornflakes or whatever during that period?
We have a little team of three, and we all seek out other employment at times. It can be through teaching experiences and a variety. And with Winner's Bone, it gave us some seed money to be able to run a very small entity called Still Rolling, which we use as our base of operation. And it is finite and it is humble, but it has enabled us to investigate a couple things until financing shows up. So, but with Leave No Trace, we got very lucky with financing.
In what way?
Some brave Canadians. Brawn.
I feel like we're entirely dependent on Canada right now for any optimism in the world. And here, once again, here they are. They financed your movie.
I concur with that. And I, had a couple really emo phone calls to Canada recently where I just had to say, will you still be my friend, So Brawn is a very active studio out of Canada and small studio, and they've financed a really diverse set of films over the last years. And with Leave No Trace, it was a real pleasure to hear that they had the interest and they were very able to work with some of the preferences and desires that I have. And that made me all kinds of happy. And then they partnered with a wonderful studio in New York called Topic. And together, these two financiers were what we needed to go forward.
Now, did you have to go to a trillion people, or were you able to somewhat focus, like these are the top three that may consider making this movie?
We did have to go to a lot, and that was done by Ann Harrison and Linda Reisman, the two producers who were sort of on the mission for the money. And they did have to go, and there was interest. People enjoyed the script. And there's that moment of pause, just attempting, even within the realm of indie or lower budget, to assess, does this have a commercial angle? Mm-hmm. And who will you hinge it upon? And I think because I can't really proffer up any names that have this immediate financeability who seem right for the film, the project becomes much more of a gamble, or it's harder for them to say yes.
I mean, we've had certain filmmakers on the show. I won't name them. There's one in my mind in particular where it was like, it felt like one of the leads was very not right. And the filmmaker kind of said, and this has happened more than once, I'm not singling out one, where they say, we needed that name and that's how we got the financing. But you are willing to resist that.
I am trying very hard. So much work goes into a film on the script level, then going into the field and doing research with real people to match and fact check what you've got in your script. And so then to put someone who is so recognizable and perhaps has even been overexposed in certain ways, it's very hard for them to meld into the real world. Mm. And therefore, coming from the neorealist tradition, it's almost a preposterous proposition. Because also, when a budget level goes up, the requirements of what's needed to sort of please people magnifies in each increment of the budget's growth. The amount of people you have to please grows. Mm. The amount of money you have to pay back grows. The needs or requirements of people who've lived a potentially rarefied sort of movie existence, or been on big sets with a lot of accoutrements and things like that, can't be accommodated in a neorealist setting. So in some ways, the genre in which I work almost excuses itself or sort of sequesters itself from those conditions because it wouldn't be a happy marriage.
Right. Well, so this particular film, of course, this is a father and daughter who are living completely in the woods. So you needed people who could be convincing. And well, I don't know who came first in terms of the cast, but the two key leads that you have.
They were very simultaneous in that we needed to be looking for them in very different ways. And really with an actor at the caliber and experience of Ben Foster, that's if he takes an interest, that's extending our interest, saying, you know, well, we'd love for you to look at the script and consider it. And he did that. And with the teen actor, it's much more of a traditional search where you're auditioning a lot of people. With teens, it's much more room for trying to seek out new people and young emerging actors who show their commitment and their interest.
So you found Thomas and Harcourt McKenzie in New Zealand. And I don't know, did you send out global notifications for young woman who looks like she can handle it? Or how do you go about doing that?
Well, the global notifications do go out. You know, she did her own return global notification by saying she was interested. So she did hear about it through, I mean, someone must have given her the script.
I think one of her parents is an acting coach or teacher.
Her mother, Miranda McKenzie, is an acting coach who's very well-regarded in New Zealand, and she's performed in films, and her father as well has deep ties and interests. And Tom, I think, has said that she was unsure whether this was her niche because it sort of seemed like it was her parents' thing. But then I think over time she's really developed her own interest.
Yes, so it must be disheartening for a teenage girl to realize they have similar interests to their parents, but we'll set that aside for now.
Right. But she actually has very hip and easy to talk to good parents. So I actually think she has very solid relationship with them. That's what appeared to me from being with them a bit, you know, in the mm-hmm. making of this film. But the way she expressed her interest was irresistible. She did a wonderful self-taping audition. And from there, we had Skype conversations in which she could tell me different impressions she had about the book, the script. It was so clear she had read things with nuance. And I was like, I'm speaking to a young person with a mind who's really still able to contact imagination. And she was able to visualize things and who's also very disciplined and wants to borrow in on things, take skills training, get her accent to work well for the purposes of this project. And she started her own journal with specimens in it. And, you know, so she took a lot of initiative. And I was like, this is so ideal for the way I make films.
I mean, you do have this thing that's both a gift and maybe a little bit of a burden of having put Jennifer Lawrence in her breakout role in Winter's Bone. And do people then look at her and say, you know, do you think she could be the next one? Or I just wonder how it plays when you're trying to put together a film like this.
I mean, in terms of trying to match something or reach an expectation, that makes me so nervous. So instead, I had to say, oh, let me just be in the here and now. Let me focus, narrow focus for a minute here. Let me give myself that safety almost, or that important place to say, I'm not matching anything. I'm not rivaling anything. I'm looking for the right person here. And the story is, you know, a humble story. And therefore, I want to be in service to that. I want to be able to still have a relationship with people who can enjoy stories like this. And they, I think, will swing with, as long as the actor is doing a rich and thorough, nuanced interpretation and giving their all, that same audience is going to respond. They, you know, they don't need to know ahead of time that I'm struggling with this notion of, is this person a breakout? So I try to put all of that in a gentle way on the sidelines so that I can kind of just dedicate myself to the here and now.
So when you find these actors, the idea is that they then have to do survival or wilderness training. And you found this teacher, somebody who's like a champion survival person. So tell me about how that worked.
That was a lucky stroke for the film because we were wondering how to make the on-screen tasks vivid but yet accurate. And we knew that it would be a feeling of fraud if these two people didn't know how to function well and feel it to be in this camp, and how, and if they've been there a long time, they would know certain things. And Nicola Pelion, as you say, she's known now as a master in this field of primitive skills and outdoor survival. She was very willing to train Ben and Tom. And, you know, in order to operate knives, it may sound a little silly, but it required, you know, to really know how to hold that knife mm-hmm. correctly to prevent injury. And that was a big part of becoming comfortable. And then Tom just excelled. Nicole's jaw dropped one day when Tom, just in her own, had been practicing this technique of feather sticking, which is to create tinder for the fire. And her feather sticks became these blossoms. And Nicole, you know, sort of said, oh, my goodness, you know, this is something that it would serve her, that she would become really adept at being able to light fires. And so it went that they spent time with her before filming began. And then they took those skills and they spent some time rehearsing together, just Ben and Tom alone, without the crew, without us being present. Made the camp their own and understood how they were going to work inside that camp. This was a really wonderful, I would say, layer to the film. And it is very manifest when watching the film, because those skills are performed throughout the entire film by Ben and Tom.
So you shot in these particular conditions, sort of rainforest, I guess, over a very fairly compressed 30 days. and you're dealing with cold, wet weather.
Well, 30 days felt outstanding to me just because it was a 5-day growth from my previous film. And then in terms of inclemency, we learned how to work with the rain. The Oregon crew was outstanding in schooling the outsiders about how to stay dry, how to keep the equipment dry. They had a lot of techniques for doing that because that is their reality. They do live in a temperate rainforest. But the rain was also, it was not lost on us. It was also going to be such an asset, such a production value for this film. It is what makes the leaves reflective. It's what makes the forest luminous. It's what makes the clothes have texture. And it's what they would have really faced. It does make their situation at times more dire because if it had been only sunny, we have the tendency to think, oh, what's the big deal? You know, it can't be that bad if it's that pretty.
Right. So idyllic. Yeah.
All people know getting too wet means you can't get warm. So I do think it's palpable on screen. And I think that viewers associate the weather they're seeing on screen with the idea that it's more arduous to survive. And you've got to put some real thought into the so-called man versus nature, you know, or people versus nature.
Or person versus nature, yeah.
Yes, person versus nature, yes.
Lose yourself in nature and find peace.
Coming up after a short break, Deborah Granick explains why she prefers to cast local people when possible, and she tells us what her next project will be if she can get the funding. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Deborah Granick, director of the new movie, Leave No Trace. The film follows a veteran with PTSD and his adolescent daughter, who have been living off the grid in the Oregon woods. In time, authorities find the two, and social services tries to establish them in more normal circumstances. Finding herself with a roof over her head, the daughter, Tom, played by Thomas and Harcourt McKenzie, finds herself getting to know neighboring kids and starting to envision a new life for herself. Her father, Will, played by Ben Foster, is much more resistant.
I think it might be easier on us if we try to adapt.
We're wearing their clothes, we're in their house, we're eating their food, we're doing their work. We have adapted. The only place we can't be seen is in this house.
We can still think our own thoughts. Like you said.
So at certain points in the movie, and I don't want to give away a lot about the movie, they are pulled, father and daughter, into different places in the, I was going to say the real world, but that's not really what I mean. You know, the world most of us live in, where there are other people and machines. And you cast local people in some of those parts. And I don't know, was that a easy or difficult decision to make and execute, I guess?
I love to be able to cast local people because once the film is set in a region, which is another draw for me or a big desire, which is to locate something in a very specific place in our vast country and then really let some of those details come forward from that place. And who best to do that than the people who live at those exact coordinates, you know, their idiosyncrasies, some of the things they might say that will inflect the script, some of the pursuits or traditions, you know, later on there was a village where they land, which the people who reside there are playing themselves in the scenes or are present in the scenes. And I was very captivated by that location. And it seems so imperative that the people who live there are present in those scenes. And in this situation, it was quite easy, I want to say, because people were doing things that they do in their everyday life. So having them be present felt like it's like a treat. I think I could apply that to the 4-H, the teenagers that participate in 4-H.
Right.
All that production value, those beautiful faces.
And beautiful bunnies.
Yes, exactly. But they also have a set of rituals and protocol that they're steeped in so that no one's learning lines. They're saying what they know. And those are moments when using real people from everyday life go well. There are times when it can be very hard to pull off for a whole host of reasons. But I would say there were numerous instances in this film where it was just a big blessing for the film.
I read a quote in an interview that you gave where you said that the union was not a possibility at your budget level. Is that just understood or did I misunderstand it myself?
Oh, no. Well, this shoot was entirely union. I think when I speak like that, it's that I would like to work really low budget sometimes. It would liberate me to be able to tell truly the stories I want to tell, and maybe with no known cast at all, which would be a very big pleasure for me. And to do that, the budget would be so low that I would have trouble meeting the requirements of the union. This was so entirely heavily union. This film was, Oregon is a very tight union state. And I'm not looking to get around union.
Right.
I just have a disconnect. I so crave for there to be that some kind of really wonderful meeting with some of the big unions in the film world to talk about how to re-envision the lowest budget levels, you know.
They do have some kind of thing for low budget, I think.
Yes, they do. And I'm researching that with a line producer right now for the next film. You know, we're looking into that very much on a serious level. So the quote sounds like it's important for me to clarify because it would really be, especially for the projects I do and things going forward, it would be pretty heinous for me to be somehow promulgating an anti-union stance regarding film unions. It's more that I've never known how to make the math work.
Right.
And that's what causes sometimes a stricken feeling like, oh, what can we do here to make this work?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is something that with as much as the film business has changed, I don't know whether those rules have been revisited in years. Let me ask you about this Barbara Ehrenreich, Nickel and Dimed, which is her piece about, you know, a person working in a non-white-collar jobs, right? She did this herself. This book is almost 20 years old, but yeah. It still seems to be quite maybe more relevant than ever.
I think so. And she has to keep updating the preface and the intro because it's reissued every year. And it's still it's heavily used in academic settings and colleges. The relevance, I think, when she first started talking about these issues, it was called a living wage. Now it's called a poverty wage. So I think the advance of pressuring and pressing on working class people has only gotten harsher. And I think the goal in trying to bring this book of hers to the screen would be to try to look at how families do their surviving and to try to understand the math of it all, now, hopefully not in a dry way, hopefully in the very active way of seeing people doing their jobs, looking for their jobs, trying to compound their incomes for survival. What happens to the children that are involved in those families? How do they fare? And of course, to do this, the characters that are selected have to be people who have a sense of humor because humor is going to be one of their weapons to get through some of this. I don't mean it's a comedy. I just mean that it's also not the death and destruction beat. It's not meant to be a dreary film. It's meant to be a film that loves on or shows admiration for people who work that hard to survive.
And what is the status? That's right in your sweet spot of regular people. You have a script and you're looking for financing. Is that the status?
That is the status. And before that, we have to do research. You know, one of our major steps is to make sure that our lookbook reveals and proves that the locations and the people are there, that the ingredients that would make this a rich American story are findable and willing.
Well, I certainly think that sounds like a tale for our times, more so than ever. Deborah Granick is the director of Leave No Trace. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.